I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today's program focuses on longstanding problems that have been accentuated by the election of Donald Trump: immigrant bashing, lack of health care, and overt racism. Jorge Mercier will be speaking with MALDEF President and General Counsel Thomas A. Sines. MALDEF is the acronym for Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. They'll be discussing ICE's recent aggressive actions, the Latino and immigrant communities' reactions, and how to mobilize allies in support of immigrants. Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Denise Morris are here to discuss the controversial new film, Get Out. But leading off today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Mark Dudzik, who has served as a national organizer of the Labor Party and is currently the national coordinator for the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Health Care. Bill?
Thanks, Tom. Mark Dudzik, welcome to KBOO.
Bill, it's great to be here.
Mark Dudzik, again, national coordinator of Labor for Single-Payer Health Care. Some time ago, he was a national organizer for the Labor Party, and he's written a lot. He got involved in politics some years ago as president of his New Jersey local of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, one of the great honorable unions in the United States and still in struggle. So, Mark, many on the left, the failure of Trump Care, at least the apparent failure of Trump Care, they're trying to reorganize and win a House majority. It was hailed, though, as a great opportunity to promote and win single payer, at least build great support for it. Certainly Bernie Sanders strongly campaigned for a single payer system, why it's so necessary. And that energized millions of people who recognize the need for it. Polls indicate that a growing majority of people are in favor of single payer. On the other side, of course, there's the insurance companies and that whole apparatus of wealth who will spend unlimited amounts of money to stop a single-payer system. The question then becomes how to win it. We're going to be talking about that later in the interview. But, Mark, first tell us about single-payer, the virtues of a single-payer system or Medicare for all.
Sure, Bill. From my perspective, nothing would do more to make life more secure for working-class Americans than to create a Medicare-for-all system which would treat health care as a birthright for everybody in America. It's the only industrialized country that doesn't treat health care as a right, and it just causes, you know, incredible stress in so many families in America. Even those who have health care, you know, are worried about the prospects of losing their health care or the prospects of not being able to pay for procedures, even though they have some coverage because of huge and growing deductibles and access to doctors. It's this crazy system which is built not to deliver health care, but to deliver profit for the medical industrial complex. And so, you know, we think that this is really a wedge issue that can really open up a whole broader debate and discussion about what the economy and society would look like if it was organized to benefit working class people rather than just the 1% that run things today. For unions, which is my constituency and the work that we do in the labor campaign, you know, the fights over health care benefits are the biggest cause of strikes and lockouts and concession bargaining. And it's a huge, huge issue. And if we could take health care off the bargaining table, we could really achieve so much more for union members in America. And in addition, we believe that by talking about health care as a public good and talking about making it a right kind of puts the union movement back at the center of working class issues and concerns, and rather than being seen as a interest group that's just fighting for the narrow health care benefits of its own members, we would be fighting for health care for the entire working class. It would help transform labor.
The other side, of course, says, oh, what are you complaining about? The American health care system is the best in the world. It provides the best care. And they, of course, frighten people by talk about long lines and all the rest of it that occur in Canada and other and the whole rest of the long lines for elective procedures. What do you make of those arguments? They're absolutely bogus, but they just keep saying it. Tell us the real story.
You know, look, I mean, number one, as you know, we spend twice as much as any other industrialized country for a system that has poorer outcomes up and down the line. But, you know, look, there's some truth to it. If you are a rich guy who needs a heart transplant, America is a pretty good place to get your health care. You know, however, if you are, you know, an African-American woman in Baltimore with diabetes, it's a horrible place, and you'd be better off in a country like Cuba than you would be in the U.S. in terms of getting access to health care. So, you know, health care is a mirror on the broad inequalities that, you know, our society generates, and it resonates up and down the system. And then, you know, I can only laugh when people talk about lines, because that's most people's experience today with our healthcare system, is rationing up and down, applying to some phone 800 number somewhere to get permission to access healthcare, and then having to jump through all kinds of gatekeepers and stuff to actually get the treatment. So most people do not have a seamless experience with healthcare today under our system, and we could do so much more with the resources that we have.
Yeah, and there are so many better systems of healthcare that could be incorporated. One thing that I think that a single-payer system could do is not only create a whole lot faster and better care for people, but really democratize the system for the people who work in it and for people who come to it. It seems to me, especially with chronic care, that hospitals, in fact, some are trying to do it and many of them are not, but that are trying to change the way that they work with people so that, in fact, people have far more knowledge and interest and support in keeping themselves healthy and keeping the family healthy, which is, it seems to me, it's quite fundamental and is not going on now in the United States. It's healthcare for profit only.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Bill. I mean, we have a system that looks at healthcare as a profit center rather than as a public service. And it's very frustrating for the people who work within that system, which is why groups like nurses are the biggest advocates for a single-payer system, because their mission is to provide health care to people, and they're so frustrated by the way the system is organized. So, you know, a single-payer would give an opportunity to rationally reorganize the health care system around human values. It doesn't solve all the problems up front, but because it's publicly administered and publicly planned, you can begin to develop a coherent plan to move forward. And we can also redeploy the hundreds of thousands of workers who are doing wasteful work under the current system and redeploy them to more useful activities and delivering real health care to people. You know, every doctor in America has at least one employee whose only job it is to argue with insurance companies about getting reimbursed for the procedures. And then, of course, every insurance company has a similar employee whose job it is to argue with that person. You know, if those folks were retrained to do community outreach and to do preventive care and healthcare education, you know, we could have a much more rational and effective system. Inside the system would feel so much better about the work that they do.
And learn a lot and become real citizens rather than shills for one of these profit-making entities. This is KBO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Mark Dudzik, who's the National Coordinator for Labor for Single-Payer Healthcare. Mark, let's talk about the politics of it. It's very clear that the healthcare system is terribly broke and that there are really quite wonderful ways of reorganizing it that are, in fact, characteristic of some clinics and in some state systems. There are some really good healthcare models out there that work. But the politics of it seems to me to be extremely difficult. Like the military, which is such a huge part of our economy, The system itself, as it exists now, has its own cheering section of shareholders and all the rest of it, this huge apparatus now that's grown up to make profits, but not really to provide health, at least not as good outcomes as countries that spend half the wealth. They're trying to revive Trump care again. What do you make of that fight now in Washington? Trump is not going to give up on this, and he's very vengeful. He's going to keep gnawing at it forever, wanting to win that battle, regardless of how ridiculous and hideous the plan is, Ryan's plan.
Yeah, well, I think there's powerful forces driving those changes that Trump and Ryan are trying to achieve. And, you know, I think that particularly from the wing of the Republican Party that Ryan represents, they see an historic opportunity to roll back what they call entitlement programs, what we call social insurance programs. You know, they see Medicaid as the most vulnerable of those programs, and they're going to keep trying to push to attack those programs and turn more and more of the healthcare market over to the for-profit insurance and healthcare delivery system. So that dynamic is going to definitely continue to play out, whether it plays out in these big reform efforts like Trump care or in the sort of death by a thousand cuts approach. You know, we're going to continue to fight these issues out. But, you know, we say that we have to fight for more than just preserving the status quo, because the status quo does a really lousy job right now, even under the best of circumstances, for delivering health care to Americans. And the programs that have been designed to try to deliver health care to Americans are all based on the flawed conception that health care ought to be treated as a commodity rather than a public good. So our vision is to keep moving forward until we win Medicare for all for everybody in America. And that's really something that's supported by the overwhelming majority of the American people. And it's something that doesn't, you know, it's not a question of developing good policy proposals at this point in time. People know how Medicare works and, you know, how it could be improved and how it could be expanded to everybody in America. It's a pretty clear-cut idea, not all that complex. So the real challenge is not the policy proposals. The challenge is confronting power. And as you said, the medical industrial complex is huge. It's the biggest and most powerful set of institutions in the history of capitalism. And to overturn that, we need a big, broad fight against corporate power, which is why institutions like the labor movement have to be at the center of this fight for health care justice, because labor is constructed to fight corporate power. We need to be oriented in that fight. So the real problem is how to build a movement against the power that sits at the center of the health care industry and stands between the American people and their health care.
You know, one of the problems, though, certainly in the short run, and in fact, in the long run, we all die, so I think we have to be thinking about the short run. In the short run, the U.S. Congress now is controlled by the various predatory industries, the military industry, the mm-hmm. parts of the agriculture, agribusiness, and the healthcare industrial complex. They're big enough and active enough and smart enough, those groups, and have lobbyists who are smart enough and huge apparatuses and machinery. It's going to be bottled up, it seems to me, at the federal level for quite a while, no matter what we do. But it is very possible that we could win state-level experiments that then could begin moving across the country and finally eventuate in a national system. Is that how people are thinking first, and what do you see happening at the state level?
That's certainly how we're thinking. We sort of have a three-point program for how to win this. You know, number one, we got to change the terms of debate nationally around healthcare, not just circling the wagons, but fighting for Medicare for all and building a broad consensus that this is the solution to the healthcare problem. And we have a really good example in that with the Social Security fights that have taken place over the last 10 years or so. You may recall that it's one of the lower points in the Obama administration. He indicated that he may be willing to do business with the Republican majorities in Congress and concede to some limitations and cutbacks on Social Security as part of what he was calling a grand bargain. Some advocates in that world, led by a group called Social Security Works, kind of flipped that debate and started demanding that we don't cut Social Security, but expand it and improve the benefits for everybody in America. And they turned that debate around. We need to do the same thing around the healthcare debate, develop a broad public consensus around what a good healthcare system would look like and begin to build political support. Second, we got to get breakthroughs at the state level because the national politics is just frozen. There's no conceivable path forward nationally over the next 2 to 4 years at least. So we got to win some breakthroughs at the state level that show that we can achieve and build a better system that costs less and provides more healthcare. And we think we can do that. There's a number of very strong state-level movements. We're looking particularly at places like California and New York, where there's strong bills being considered right now. We think the whole West Coast, from Washington down into Nevada, is ripe for some real state-level initiatives just because of the politics that have developed on the West Coast. And some of the northeastern states are also open to that. So we're really looking to make some breakthroughs at the state level. We think that can happen. You cannot build a pure single-payer system at a state level, but you could create a publicly administered universal health plan at state levels that would really work. And then finally, then we come back to the national. From those victories at the state level, we move back to a national movement, and we build the healthcare movement nationally as part of a much broader movement to reclaim the public good in a number of areas like education and job planning and environmental issues. You know, we've got to oppose, be part of this movement against the privatization and commodification of, you know, all of the indicators of qualities of life for working class people. And I think we can do that based on the victories that we win at the state level.
That raises a couple of questions. This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here talking to Mark Dudzik, who's a national coordinator of Labor for Single Payer, which is a very important for the left national movement to bring Medicare for All. Medicare for All is such a great way of talking about a universal health care system because people know how well Medicare works. The elderly are devoted to Medicare, and families, very few don't have a few elderly people who get good medical care or reasonable care now on it. Mark, we were talking about state systems and possibilities at the state level, and you said that it could not be a full system as we'd want. It appears over the last couple of years, one of the ways the states have tried to build that system, and sometimes often coming up short, like in Vermont or Colorado, where the industry and some of the Democratic Party politicians managed to destroy it, like in Vermont, that was very close. And during the Obama administration, the Health and Human Services Department allowed waivers for those states so they could convert a lot of the money they're now spending into a universal system. But it would require a lot of waivers. Am I wrong about that, or could it actually be set up without having to get the Trump administration to support the experiments?
It would require some waivers under the Affordable Care Act because you have to replace these state private insurance exchanges with a public insurance system. That section of the ACA is still in legal force, but we would have to apply for waivers to the federal government in order to implement the state program. So there's a political calculation there. And then there's just some complexities about integrating all of the federal monies that flow into the healthcare system into a public fund from Medicaid and Medicare and the Children's Health Insurance Program and public preventive primary care clinics and a number of other sources, veterans health care, into a rational system that would require some innovative techniques to do so. And there's a lot of thinking about how to do that in the most efficient way. But obviously the cleanest way to do it would be to have one national Medicare for All plan and just do that transition nationally. But the political way forward is going to run through the states, we do believe.
Ultimately, it seems to me that it depends on winning enormous amounts of public support for Medicare for All, such that the informed support recognizing the falsity of the claims of the medical profiteering complex and able to explain that to the neighbors. Right now we're in that, it seems to me, we have to be in a process of educating people and gaining those commitments. I'm sure you agree. Tell us how it's done.
We in the labor movement call that inoculation. When you're organizing workers to join a union, you know that as soon as you go public, the employer is going to do all kinds of things to discourage people from uniting into a union and spread all kinds of lies and fear and misinformation and division. And so we've learned over the years that the only way to counter that is to prepare people for it in advance and let them know what is coming and how to respond to those arguments. We think we really have to do that even more so on this healthcare fight so that your people are prepared when they tell people that this is going to be the biggest tax increase in human history and that they'll never ever be able to see their family doctor again and all of these things that we know is coming. People got to be prepared to understand those arguments and to speak to their neighbors about them. So we really need to be ready. I think where single-payer movements at the state level have floundered is when they've gotten overconfident and have not realized how desperate the medical industrial complex will fight to prevent, even in a small state like Vermont, you know, which, you know, they could certainly lose that state from a profits perspective and not collapse, but they knew that the example of even a little place like Vermont treating health care as a right would destroy their business model nationally, and they'll fight like the devil to hold on to that.
One final issue, the Democratic Party. In writing the platform when Bernie and Hillary were at odds, the health system became a huge struggle. And Sanders' forces lost. Single-payer Medicare for all did not appear in the platform. It seems to me that that fight within the party is going to go on through this period and into the 2018 elections and then the 2020 presidential elections. So many of the Democrats, it seems to me, some of them just support the profiteering and others are just afraid of the profiteers, but are not going to want to take a stand. How does that affect the whole struggle?
Well, I think if we rely on a Democratic Party to carry our water on this struggle, Bill, I think we'll constantly be defeated. I think we have to build powerful, issue-based, independent movements around health care justice and force the politicians to come to us. I just don't think that a party like that that relies on Wall Street money and self-funded campaigns, which means billionaires paying for their own political campaigns, is going to, on its own, deliver health care.
The party won't, but the party faithful, a lot of them, are going to move towards universal health care, it seems to me, if we do a good job.
Absolutely. The base of the Democratic Party believes in these issues. And, you know, the sad thing is they often believe that their party is moving towards those issues when, in fact, it's moving in the opposite way. So there needs to be an awakening. You know, I think Bernie has done an amazing job pointing out these contradictions. And, well, you know, politics is really in flux right now. It's in transformation. And it's a desperate time, but it's also a very exciting time to think about what can emerge from these dark days. And I'm very hopeful that we're going to emerge with a much more powerful movement that's going to fight for real working class interests.
Yeah, and in Oregon, too. Don't forget about little old Oregon here on the West Coast. Mark Dudzik, thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's a pleasure, Bill.
Right, so long.
Well, I'm sure Van Halen and David Lee Roth, the singer, would have no trouble getting a doctor. But for many, if Trump has his way, that may not be so easy. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Lori Mercier is here with Thomas A. Sines, President and General Counsel of MALDEF, the acronym for Mexican American Legal Defense Fund.
Thanks, Tom. Thomas Sines is a civil rights attorney, as you heard, and with MALDEF, Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, where he has successfully led challenges to California's unconstitutional Proposition 187, which tried to exclude immigrants residing in the country without legal permission to access public benefits. And he's led numerous other civil rights cases in the areas of immigrants' rights, education, employment, and voting rights. Welcome to KABU, Thomas Sines. Just last week, 84 undocumented immigrants in Oregon and Washington were arrested during a three-day sweep by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents. And although Homeland Security Chief John Kelly claims his agents are targeting immigrants charged with crimes, the majority of those arrested and detained in no way represent a threat to public safety. And we're seeing these kinds of high-profile raids across the country. What is really happening here?
Well, it's somewhat unclear. It's not obvious whether this is being directed by Secretary Kelly or the National Department of Homeland Security. Or what appears more likely is that agents around the country are basically doing what they would like to do, having received a message through the rhetoric of the president and the secretary and executive orders and implementing memoranda, that basically they won't be constrained, as they might have been previously, from engaging in aggressive enforcement conduct, including enforcement that clearly does not target those who would be enforcement priorities under any reasonable definition of the term.
So how have these policies and approaches changed since the Obama administration? Because certainly under Obama and his 8 years, 2 million immigrants were deported. And even though the Obama administration tried to rein in ICE in many ways, they also, during that time, were targeting people who were not threats to public safety.
Well, as you've indicated, there were serious problems with the Obama administration's enforcement activities through the first 7-plus years of the administration. So it's still not clear whether these are substantially different, these current practices, or not. It does appear that agents have received a message that whatever constraints they may have believed they were under, they are no longer under. And I think that's why we've seen, for example, at least 4 holders of deferred action for childhood arrivals who have been arrested and detained despite having deferred action. We've seen perhaps increases in collateral arrests, at least more public awareness of collateral arrests, which are those who are arrested even though they have nothing to do with a warrant being executed, but happen to be in the vicinity, whether in the same home or in the neighborhood, and happen to come in contact with ICE agents who are executing a warrant on a specific individual. So there certainly does seem to have been a change. It's not clear whether that's a change directed from Washington, D.C., or more likely simply a loosening or a perceived loosening of any constraints that agents were under previously.
And is there evidence that ICE is targeting certain states and locations? I mean, of course, we in the Pacific Northwest are aware of these cases affecting us locally in the Portland and Seattle areas. And I'm sure you are in Southern California. But does there seem to be evidence that the West Coast, which has mounted a prominent resistance to these Trump orders, and states declaring sanctuary cities and states themselves declaring sanctuary for immigrants, does there seem to be a targeting of these areas to punish the West Coast?
Well, there are 2 things going on. First, there is, I think, some pretty strong evidence coming forward that the city of Austin, Texas, may have been targeted because of its policies, which were clearly in favor of immigrant integration. But what's important about Austin is that it sits in a state that has indicated quite clearly that it is interested in cooperating with the Trump enforcement agenda. And I think that indicates that state policy makes a difference. I think it's clear they understand they will have greater success in arresting and detaining more individuals where the state is cooperating than in those states where there is no cooperation. So it does make a difference that California and Oregon and Washington, as states, pursue policies that are welcoming of immigrants and protective of immigrants. It does certainly make a difference. By the same token, it is troubling, the evidence about Austin, Texas, suggesting that the administration is targeting jurisdictions because of their political views, which would be contrary to any sense of federalism, any sense of fairness and constitutionality that we would have believed in at least prior to January 20th.
And in addition to targeting particular areas that have tried to mount defenses of its of their immigrant residents, there's also the racialized immigration policies that are targeting brown Muslims and Latinos, Africans. And so what evidence exists that there's that kind of racialized targeting happening as well?
Well, unfortunately, our immigration removal system has for many, many, many years shown a significant discriminatory effect where Latino immigrants are put into deportation at a far higher rate than they represent among those who are undocumented. So that certainly continues under the same folks, ICE agents, Border Patrol, that were engaged in that conduct with discriminatory patterns previously. In addition, we have the administration's interest in involving local law enforcement in immigration enforcement through a promotion of the what was believed to be nearly dead 287G program, under which by contract local law enforcement agents are actually deputized to engage in immigration enforcement, and through the increased use of detainers and the attempt to highlight those who refuse to honor detainer requests, which are requests by ICE to hold someone longer than they are constitutionally allowed to be held on a state-related arrest, simply so that ICE can take its time in taking that person into custody. So we see a number of indications that there is an interest in involving local law enforcement in immigration enforcement. But we know that when you do that, you're basically inviting racial profiling. Untrained or inadequately trained local law enforcement agents are going to enforce immigration laws based on their own stereotypes about who is undocumented. Unfortunately, those stereotypes are inaccurate, but depict the undocumented largely as Mexican, Latino, and secondarily as Muslims, because Muslims are, by stereotype, viewed as somehow suspect. So we have an administration that is positively inviting racial profiling to increase, and that follows on a pattern longstanding of discriminatory results in who is put in detention and deportation.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like there is all, in addition to encouraging local police and local activities that would further practice existing racial profiling, there is this creation of intense fear and this heightened sense of anxiety, which has affected Latino communities in the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere in the country. Is that part of the strategy, too, to create this kind of atmosphere of fear that then leads to self-deportation or fewer immigrants to the United States?
I think that's the central strategy so far from the administration, because so many of the announcements that they've made are not actually implementable because they haven't taken the legal steps to implement them. But I think through the executive orders and implementing memoranda, even though they announce policies that are not yet legally implementable, together with leaked executive orders that don't get issued at all, are all designed to create confusion and fear, to do exactly what you've described, to make life difficult, so full of anxiety and concern that immigrants will on their own decide to withdraw from society and perhaps leave the country. Now, this attempt at coercing self-deportation, which we hadn't really heard much of since the 2012 presidential campaign following Arizona's invocation of the policy as a support for SB 1070, is really a despicable way of dealing with the issue. It's not about engaging in actual government activity. It's about creating fear and anxiety in children, even infants, who pick up the anxiety of their parents. It's about splitting apart families. It's a terrible legacy for the first 100 days of this administration.
Yes, it's a terrible psychological and health impact to wreak on large numbers of people in communities. So how do we push back? How do we, as allies, support our immigrant neighbors?
Well, I think we have to work with everyone to understand their rights, know their rights, get the resources to know them, to understand that they should never waive their rights. There are certainly going to be attempts, as we've seen already, by ICE agents to coerce immigrants, even immigrants with lawful status, to waive their rights to due process, and no one should ever do that. But it's not easy to say no to an agent who is attempting very, very much to get you to sign a piece of paper. So the third thing is we have to let everyone know that when they exercise their rights and refuse to waive them, they will not be alone. They will be supported, and there will be resources and support in the community for their rights to due process, for their rights that many of them have to remain in the United States. I think those are the most important messages to get out, and obviously with respect to the third, it's something that all of us can engage in. But second, we can, of course, call upon our representatives in the House and in the Senate and not to acquiesce in this campaign of psychological fear and confusion, and to investigate what the Trump administration is doing and put limits on what it is doing, because it is a truly despicable and inhumane way of addressing a very human issue of immigration to this country.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Thomas Sines of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, MALDEF. We appreciate you joining us at the Old Mole Variety Hour today.
Thank you.
Crops are all in and the lettuce is rotting. The oranges are piling their creosote dumps. Taking them back to that Mexican border. Pay all their money and wait back again. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios.
Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. You won't have a name when you ride that big airplane. All they will call you will be deportee. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. As the two interviews you just heard demonstrate, it is imperative for people to organize and take action against the Trump administration's assault on human rights and human decency. Hence our new weekly feature, the Old Mole Community Action Calendar. Tuesday, the 4th of April, that's tomorrow, at 7 p.m., Cinema 21 Theater, along with theaters all over the country, is showing 1984. Based on George Orwell's novel of a government that manufactures their own facts, demands total obedience, and demonizes the press and foreigners. Ticket sales, $12, will benefit Causa Oregon, a statewide organization that fights for civil and human rights of Latino immigrants and their families. This coming Saturday, April 8th, the Portland Troublemakers School is having a gathering for a day of skill-building workshops that will help union members and labor activists build power on the job. To be held at the United Association Local 290 in Tualatin. The fee is $10 and registration is required. Go to the Portland Troublemakers School website to register and learn all the details. Now concluding today's program, Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Denise Morris are here to review the film Get Out, claimed by some to be a play on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and by others a horror film, but one with a message. But first, a little of the music that opens and closes the film.
Jan Hawken this morning to review the film Get Out. You just heard a piece of music that's used to open and close the film. Its Swahili phrase translates to listen to your ancestors, loosely meaning something bad is coming, run. And it works very well for a horror film. Jordan Peele talks about the whole idea of the movie is get out, and it's what we're screaming at the character on screen. Get Out is indeed a new film written, produced, and directed by Jordan Peele. It is his directorial debut. The film stars Daniel Kaluuya as a successful photographer, Chris Washington, Allison Williams as girlfriend Rose Armitage, and Catherine Keener as Rose's psychiatrist mother, Missy. An interesting name choice for her character. We'll talk about her later.
As is Rose.
Oh, yes.
As
oh,
is indeed. This family, Armitage.
Yeah. Yes. It does kind of harken to something very epic and plantation.
I think it has to do with a hermited world, too. But that we may be digressing too quickly.
Right, we'll get back to that.
Film rich with potential minutiae for film buffs.
Exactly. And it's been out for a while, so we'll do our best to hide the best kept secrets, but we'll try to dig in. It was released in February of this year. It's being called a comedy horror film, with the plot centering on Chris, a black man, going to meet his white girlfriend, Rose's affluent family, for the first time. And as Chris and Rose prepare to leave on their journey at the beginning of the film, their journey to the suburbs, we encounter a dynamic that looks a lot like a kind of common dysfunction that comes from the trials an interracial couple might face, and particularly when well-meaning liberal white folks may be involved and are involved in this case. And that might be a horror enough on its own, but Jordan Peele has much more to say and does it using humor and a host of tried and true popular film genres. Regarding comedy and horror, Peele feels the genres are similar in that, quote, so much of it is pacing, so much of it reveals. And in fact, Peele has said The Stepford Wives provided inspiration, calling it a horror movie with a satirical premise.
Yeah, and I think it'd be worth looking at some of the reviews and discussion around the original Stepford Wives that came out in 1975 in a remake version 2004. And I think that Jordan Peele took very much to heart some of the criticisms of those films in creating his own political satire. Of course, Stepford Wives was about feminism and male domination, not being able to accept the resistance of women to male domination, and feminism was a central theme of it. A 1975 critic concluded, quote, it's never really believable, but it tries to be, and it would have had a better chance as straight satirical commentary. It's not funny. Then another critic in the 2004 version said, another bad idea from the Bad Ideas Factory. It's an all-new, low-IQ version of Brian Forbes' 1975 movie of the Ira Levin bestseller. And the couple who move into an upscale suburban neighborhood where the creepy menfolk capture to replace their wives with sexy, submissive robots, a theme we see in this film as well. But it's interesting how he does make a very smart movie and walk this line between straight up political satire and the absurdities of horror films. And some of the absurdities, I think, didn't entirely work by the end of the film. But that's a small criticism set against the work of it, which is very impressive in terms of how he brings in humor with these two friends who have also different fates in racist America.
Yeah, the one being around class.
Yeah, and the one main character, Chris, who's very much seduced by this white bourgeois world.
Interestingly, in the note of influences, I had this Rosemary's Baby kind of feeling, and it turns out that others did as well.
Yeah, and I Levin also wrote Rosemary's Babies.
Yeah,
so
both.
So that was also being seduced by the devil that destroys you.
Right, and in this case, the devil, the pact is with racism, and that is the devil, I would say. I liked Roger Ebert. He's still good. He still comes up with good stuff. And he has this to say, with the film is essentially about that unsettling feeling when you know you don't belong somewhere, when you know you're unwanted or perhaps even wanted too much, and suggests that Peele, infuses an age-old genre, this knowing something is wrong behind the closed doors around you with a racial and satirical edge. So I think that's a good formation for that.
And the film opens with that scene that kind of is very familiar about a black man being at risk on the streets, but also draws on this idea of the safety of the suburbs
right.
for whites and how girls are warned in so many films to be cautious about the, quote, dangerous black man. And it completely flips that, turns it on its head, because this guy is in lethal danger in this white suburban affluent world.
Right. And Ebert actually goes on to ask, is Chris overreacting to everyday racial tension, but realizing that essentially, what if going home to meet your girlfriend's white parents wasn't just uncomfortable, but downright life-threatening? And so Peel himself isn't seduced just by a kind of slasher horror.
No. It's much more the intimate side of oppression, where sexual intimacy, like with Stepford Wives, it's about the erotics of submission and relations of domination, where there is a kind of mutual participation, although that isn't so highlighted here, other than in the scenes where he is hypnotized by the psychiatrist, the malevolent psychiatrist, mother of the family, and it does imply he is being seduced by this world and is engaged in his own struggle.
Yeah, and what I really like about the film, hopefully it works for lots of people in lots of ways, but there's a way that an informed or even mildly informed viewer can see some of that subtlety that is playing out, where the film is able to move from what we may say as common dysfunction, not to dismiss it, but to say these are sort of the everyday racist or discomfort.
And what some call microaggressions.
Right, exactly. And then
small slights that have a cumulative effect.
Obviously moves through to this completely other side of the continuum. And it does it in a way that's both kind of believable, but also completely fantastic, using right. sci-fi, for example.
Especially when this psychosurgeon steps in, neurosurgeon steps in where the psychiatrist fails, and then it gets really wild.
Yeah, it does. And it's hard to say that it's fun. I mean, humor is so essential to make this work, I think. And you pointed out at the beginning, it's one of the failings that was leveled against the Stepford Wives, a film that highly influenced yeah. him. But
he's smart with the humor, though, because it's this working class friend who works at TSA who picks up on what's going on. They're trying to make sex slaves out of black men, and his colleagues laugh at him. And he's partly spot on, not entirely.
Character who is free to be paranoid.
Right.
Under the circumstances.
The TSA, right.
Which, you know,
that's right.
Chris's paranoia has to be tempered in order to kind of survive
and to navigate in a very yeah. affluent world, because
absolutely.
He's also very successful and upwardly mobile. So it is a cautionary tale about upward mobility as well. And I guess the seductions for a black bourgeoisie mm-hmm. and into a white bourgeois destructive world. And it's also about envy, not only hostility, but feeling yourself an object of what Frantz Fanon would call the colonial gaze that wants to possess you as well as to kill you.
Right. And I mean, that alone, that's a great place to end, because that, I think, is operating really fully.
Yeah. And just as a side note, I think reading Black Skin, White Mass by Afro-Caribbean psychoanalyst Frantz Fanon would be a good first study guide to include in your study guide on the film.
The Get Out study guide.
That's right.
Well, I'm Denise Morris. I'm with Jan Hocken this morning for The Old Mole, and we have been reviewing the film Get Out, directed by Jordan Peele.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. This is KBOO Portland.